Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Zen Buddhism by the numbers, number 5. Skandhas, precepts, hindrances, and ranks. 5 skandhas, 5 grave precepts, 5 hindrances, sensory desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt. 5 degrees of enlightenment, Tozan's 5 ranks. Bodhisattva blues. Avalokiteshvara, great bodhisattva of compassion, seeing things just as they are, knew in her bones that the 5 skandhas are shunyata. Everybody, everywhere, everything, anyone, neither here nor there, but never not here, never not there, not born, not dying, beyond, totally beyond. Listen, she told Sariputra, just see things as they are, as they really are. Stop worrying. It's all over anyway. Gone. Gone. There is no other shore. Just this. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgati, bodhisvaha. Gone, baby, gone. All the way gone. That's what I'm talking about. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It feels a little strange to be saying it's middle day of session. I'm not used to a short one like this, but yes, it's the middle day of session, so if you haven't gotten it yet, hurry up and get it. So when I was preparing this Tay show, of course, I heard the wonderful teishos of Ryoju and Shinge Roshi, and they put me in the mood to wander down memory lane a little bit, which is not something I usually do. I don't particularly like talking about myself. But I thought, what the heck, I might as well. So I came here at first when I was quite young. I was 22 years old, actually 21 the first time I visited, and then turned 22 by the time I was able to make it here for Kese, which was not very far afterwards. And the thing that most caught me when I came here was this really deep sense of place and a sense of being at home. And just recently, a few months ago, I found a poem by a Scottish poet named Carol Ann Duffy, who was the poet laureate of Scotland, that conveyed a good deal of that sense of finding myself at home. And I'll read it to you now. It's called Plain Song. Plain Song, for anybody who's not familiar with the term, is the type of music, European music of the Middle Ages, that we usually call Gregorian chant. Plain Song. Stop. Along this path, in phrases of light, trees sing their leaves. No Midas touch has turned the wood to gold late in the year when you pass by, suddenly sad. Straining to remember something you're sure you knew. Listening. The words you have for things die in your heart. But grasses are plain song. Patiently chanting the circles you cannot repeat or understand. This is your homeland, lost one. Stranger who speaks with tears. It is almost impossible to be here, and yet you kneel, no one's child, absolved by late sun through the branches of a wood. Distantly, the evening bell reminding you, home, home, home. And the stone in your palm telling the time. There are things that can be said in poetry that can't be said in any other way. So more than any idea about Dharma, more than any desire to be with this or that teacher, Rinzai Soto, I was 22 years old and completely ignorant. I didn't know a damn thing. But I knew as soon as I came that this was my home. And so many things have happened. Wonderful things, terrible things. The years have gone by. The Sangha has grown and shrunk and grown and shrunk. Many students leaving as I left long ago. My ordination teacher was Edo Roshi, who I imagine many people here know Edo Roshi, and many people know of him only by reputation. He was a complex man. His depth of understanding, his keen intelligence, his strength of spirit, truly unparalleled. And he had a gift for inspiring in his students the great desire to get to the bottom of this, to go all the way through. to know what cannot be put into words, what is our true nature, what is true vision. He had this wonderful gift for inspiring people. But he was a complex man. And I mentioned in the text under the number 5 in Zen Buddhism by the numbers are 5 hindrances. And first of the hindrances is sensory desire. Everyone has these hindrances. Everyone deals with them in their own way. They are not something to run away from or to deny, but something to understand and to manage, to live with, to use as a goad for our practice, to use to spur us to dig deeper. Eda Roshi's great hindrance was sensory desire. And that hindrance caused great pain. I mentioned the Sangha growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking. Almost like a natural process, like the changing of seasons. But it happened mostly because of scandal and Eda Roshi's great hindrance. So during one of those peaks of growing, I came. During one of those waves of leaving, I left. But I never lost the feeling that this place was my home. Nor did I lose my respect for Eda Roshi's tremendous gifts. There's a poem by Rumi, who was a Persian poet in the Middle Ages. He lived in the 13th century. And although he was writing in certainly a very different tradition than the Zen tradition, his words resonate so perfectly with this practice and with the desire for awakening. This is from his masterpiece, the Mathnavi, volume 6, number 634. And it's translated by Rafiq Abdullah. You cannot shun sunlight no more than the softest rose survives without its liquid beams. Plant your inner space with seed, where feathers of flame play gracefully. There's something higher we know, But you say, not more, not this, not that. I do not know, but beyond your cautious knots, you must see and say what really is without not knowing. This is the feeling of intense desire for awakening. You cannot shun sunlight. The light of awakening. No more than the softest rose survives without its liquid beams. Plant your inner space with seed, where feathers of flame play gracefully. This is what we're doing when we do Zazen. It may not feel that way. It may feel like a trial. It may feel wonderful. It may feel like a challenge. It may feel like dullness and sleepiness or aches and pains. It may feel all kinds of different ways, but what we're doing is we're planting our inner space with seed. And it's our desire, our longing for our true nature that is the flame that plays gracefully. There's something higher we know, but you say, not more, not this, not that. I do not know. Who was it who said, not knowing is most intimate? And look beyond your cautious knots. You must see and say what really is without not knowing. And that's what you do in Dokusan. All your cautious, not this, not that. But you must see and say. How many koans is just one master or another grabbing somebody and say, say, speak. Get it out of you. And that was Eido Roshi's gift, was to inspire. So I left the monastery before my 1,000-day training period was over, which I've always regretted. But it seemed at the time that it was a necessary thing to do. And it was a long, winding road that led me back to Zen practice. I left the monastery. I had dropped out of college to go to the monastery, and I went back to college when I left the monastery and became a physician and got married and had children, and all of the machinery of building what we call a life. And sometimes wonderful, sometimes terrible, just like every other day. My wife now, I've been with for 40 years. I have 3 grown children. And during most of that time when I was going to medical school and doing residency and having children and raising them, I still felt as if there was something. As if I were homeless, even as I built a home and a life. So eventually, through many twists and turns, I found my old Dharma brother and best friend while I was here at the monastery, Denko Osho, John Mortensen, who had opened a zendo in his home not far from where I lived in Connecticut at the time. And something very strange happened, which I don't really want to go into, but I had a sort of vision that convinced me that there was nothing that I could do except to return to Zen practice and to being a monk. What that would look like now that I had a wife and children and medical practice, I didn't really know. But I knew that I had to do it. And so I found my way back to the monastery and back to this place that is my home. And it was a little awkward in some ways because Eido Roshi had stopped being my teacher and I couldn't, in good faith, call him my teacher. There was too much water under the bridge on both sides, and it just was a very difficult situation. And Denko Osho was at one point the vice abbot of the monastery and was able to, study with him at his zendo at Pine Hill Zendo in Katona, New York. And he gave Dokusan here in DBZ. But then something happened and he decided that it was time to leave America and go back to Denmark, which is where he was from. And so again, I was without a teacher, with a home, but without a teacher. And I was very much at a loss as to how to proceed. I actually tried a few other practices, some other Zen centers, but nothing felt like home. This felt like home. And then in 2010, Eido Roshi's hindrance again raised its head, and this time, perhaps because times had changed, attitudes had changed, the Sangha had changed, this time instead of the Sangha leaving, the board asked Eido Roshi to step down. And of course, Shinge Roshi was nominated and thankfully accepted the role of abbot, taking over in a difficult, difficult time. And I was there for the Rohatsu session, which was Eido Roshi's last session here, in which it was clear that Shinge Roshi was going to become abbot. And I really didn't know Shinge Roshi at all at that point. We had met very, very briefly at a ceremony at Pine Hill Zendo. We exchanged maybe 5 words on each side, maybe. And she didn't know me. And yet, for some reason, she saw something in me. Perhaps she saw that I was somebody who was at home. I'm not sure. But she asked if I would be interested in giving a Dharma talk and taking a more active role, for which I'm very grateful, because honestly, there's nothing that I love more than teaching. Shinge Roshi did everything the way a blind person navigates a cliff. It's frightening, terrifying. You know that mistakes will be made, and yet you can't make a mistake. She managed the most difficult of times. And my only desire was to help her in whatever way I could possibly help her so that she would succeed. For the survival of this monastery and the Zen Studies Society, and from a greedy desire to maintain my home. It's okay to be greedy sometimes. This was my home, and I wanted to protect it. I wanted to see it survive. I wanted to see Shinge Roshi succeed. And so I offered essentially whatever you need. Just let me know. And now, 13 years later, we have survived the shocks. We have grown. I have to leave some material for the retirement ceremony because I'm going to be asked to speak as board president. And I don't want to ruin everything at this moment, so I'll not go into any more detail. But I don't know how to. expressing the deepest gratitude I can.
It's not over yet, even though I got shoot.
I still haven't said anything about the skandhas. So, I've been doing this series of talks on what I call Zen Buddhism by the numbers, which is basically just a way to introduce various concepts and ideas and vocabulary that is helpful in practicing Zen. We do a lot of chanting and talking about things, and for some students, for many students, the terms are just gobbledygook. I mean, skandhas, what the hell are skandhas? Right? You see it in the Heart Sutra, but what's a skandha? The skandhas are what everything that you can think of, see, touch, feel, remember, dream of, imagine, consists of. No skandhas, no universe. And what they are, in a sense, are the filters through which beings perceive and appreciate existence, reality. You know, we have these five senses. That's what is known as form. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. And these are just filters. They're receptors, to put it in neurological term. You know, you've got eyes that see a certain frequency of the electromagnetic spectrum. Not a very large band of the electromagnetic spectrum, just what we call light. We don't see X-rays, we don't see ultraviolet, we don't see infrared, we don't see radio waves. You know, all of those waves are out there, but we don't know about them because our filters aren't made for those frequencies. The same thing for hearing. Dogs hear things that we don't hear. I'm sure some insects or birds hear other things. Whales can hear tones so far lower than we can hear that, you know, we can feel kind of a vibration, but we can't hear it because we have human filters. We get a certain bandwidth. And the same thing with the other senses, smelling. You know, compare our sense of smell to a bloodhound's. Pathetic. And you might think, okay, so we've got the five senses, that's form, right? No. Doesn't work that way. Because, okay, you've got these filters that allow in these sensations, the bandwidth of hearing, the bandwidth of light. But you can't make heads or tails out of that without thought, without perception, mental formation. You know, there have been people who have had their eyesight restored, having been born blind, and they have this operation and can see. But what do they see? A blur. They can't make heads or tails out of it. And perhaps with time they can learn to make heads or tails out of it, but without interpretation, the five senses doesn't do a thing for us. And feeling likewise, without emotional response, the five senses don't really have any tone that would be completely lacking. You see a sunset and you have an emotional response. You see a child hungry, you have an emotional response. And you might think that you can filter out the emotional response from the sensation, but that's not the way our heart and mind works. Just as we can't make heads or tails out of things without mental formation, we can't make heads or tails out of things without emotional response either. And Buddhist psychology is very old and very wise in being able to tease out all of these various inputs, all of the ways that our perception works. And essentially, without form, there's no feeling. Without feeling, there's no thought. Without thought, there's no volition. And without all of these, there's no consciousness. You take one out, and it's like a house of cards. There you go. All destroyed. And that's essentially what the Heart Sutra is about. And when I was preparing this talk, I wanted to talk about the Heart Sutra. But, you know, we've heard the Heart Sutra over and over and over again. And like anything else that you hear over and over again, it loses its impact. So I was looking for a different translation to maybe give a little fresher idea about the Heart Sutra. And I found a translation that was done by Thich Nhat Hanh a few years back. And instead of the Heart Sutra, he calls it the insight that brings us to the other shore. And this gets me into the subject of translation, which is something I could talk about for a long time. But translation, you know, we think about translating from one language to another. And that's very difficult, but everything that we perceive, everything that we can think of, whether we put it into words or not into words, is an act of translation. The five skandhas are being translated in our minds, in our hearts, all the time. Translation is the means of perception. Just as without mental formations, thought, you can't make sense of your senses, so too with all of the other aspects of existence. We translate through our feelings, we translate through our thoughts, we translate through our volition. And so all day long we are interacting with a world which is unintelligible and making it intelligible through the act of translating, through the act of the filters that we have and the manipulation of input by our senses, by our thoughts, by our feelings, by our volition, by our memories, our fears, our desires. It's a constant act of translation. And sometimes you can translate those things into words. And when you do, you can have a conversation, you can write a book, you can write poetry. And then when you try to translate from one set of words in one language into another set of words, it's a whole other action. Just as you've translated a feeling into words, or dreams into words, when you have a text in one language and you try to put it into another language, everything that is in you, your sensory awareness, your feelings, your thoughts, your mental framework, your societal framework, your cultural framework, your biases, your prejudices. And I don't mean prejudices only in a negative sense, prejudice for or against. They all come into it. And so the act of translating is really a very complex process, which is why if I ever read a poem that is from another language, I'll always give credit to the translator, because there's no such thing as the Rumi or the Kabir. It's hard enough saying that reading a poem in your own language is in some way a satisfactory translation of what the poet is trying to say, much less getting it secondhand. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh's translation of the Heart Sutra, and he just calls it not the Heart Sutra, but the insight that brings us to the other shore, which is a nice poetic way of talking about Prajnaparamita. But it seems a little stuffy to me. The whole idea of this shore and the other shore, just, it's hard to resonate with, but that is the way it's been put in the past. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh's version. Avalokiteshvara, while practicing deeply with the insight that brings us to the other shore, that is to say, doing deep prajnaparamita, suddenly discovered that all of the five skandhas are equally empty. And with this realization, he overcame all ill-being. Listen, Shariputra, this body itself is emptiness. And emptiness itself is this body. This body is not other than emptiness, and emptiness is not other than this body. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. Listen, Shariputra, all phenomena bear the mark of emptiness. Their true nature is the nature of no birth, no death, no being, no non-being, no defilement, no purity, no increasing, no decreasing. That is why in emptiness, body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are not separate self-entities. And he goes on in that vein. It's worth checking out. You can easily find it online. It's a nice alternate version of the Heart Sutra. But while I was reading it, I suddenly got kind of a whimsical desire to make my own translation of the Heart Sutra and shorten it, you know. The Heart Sutra is a short version of the Diamond Sutra, and Mu is a shorter version of the Heart Sutra. And so I came up with this Bodhisattva Blues. Avalokiteshvara, great Bodhisattva of compassion, seeing things just as they are, knew in her bones that the five skandhas are shunyata. Everybody, everywhere, everything, anyone, neither here nor there, but never not here, never not there, not born, not dying, beyond, totally beyond. Listen, she told Sariputra, just see things as they really are, as they really are. Stop worrying. It's all over anyway. Gone, gone. There's no other shore, just this. So that's a shorter version of the Heart Sutra. All the main points are there. Bodhidharma said, when you're deluded, there's the other shore. When you're awakened, there is no other shore. Right where you are, that's it. Right where you are, that's it. That's the whole kit and caboodle. Seeing things just as they are, that's the other shore. Seeing things just as they are, seeing that there is no form without feeling, without thought, without volition, without consciousness, none of that. It's all a house of cards. It's there, it's not there. It's not real and it's not unreal. It's a little hard to wrap your head around. There's a poem by an Indian poet named Kabir, who was a bit later than Rumi. Nobody's quite sure when he was born. Maybe 1448, that's one guess. People do know that he died in 1518. So he was what we would call roughly the time of the European Renaissance. well before Hakolin, but quite a bit after Zen was introduced into Japan. Roughly around the time that Columbus discovered this place that had been discovered a long time before and ruined it for everybody. So Kabir was, he was a Muslim, but when he was still a young man, he found a Hindu teacher. His guru was Hindu. And this caused no end of consternation. And while he was alive, he was pretty much shunned by the Muslims and shunned by the Hindus. And then after he died, everybody wanted to claim him as their own. Kabir is a wonderful, wonderful poet. He didn't write his poetry down. He said it extemporaneously, and his disciples, friends, whatever you would want to call them, wrote it down. And so it's hard to say that there's a definitive version of any of his poems. And he's one who has been translated into English quite a bit. Some of the earliest translations are rather formal and stuffy, and they have a kind of charm, but they seem so outdated. There was a translation by an Indian poet who also, I believe, won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I'll probably massacre his name, Rabindranath Tagore, published a translation in 1915. And even for 1915, it seemed a bit old-fashioned and formal. This is interpreted by Robert Bly, who does not speak Hindi, and I assume that he was working with Tagore's translation and simply making it more palatable to the modern reader. He doesn't leave anything out, but he changes things in a way which make it easier for us to understand. I said to the wanting creature inside me, "What is this river you want to cross? There are no travelers on the river road, and no road. Do you see anyone moving about on that bank or resting? There's no river at all, and no boat, and no boatman. There's no tow rope either, and no one to pull it. There's no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford. And there's no body and no mind. Do you believe there is some place that will make the soul less thirsty? In that great absence, you will find nothing. Be strong then, and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place for your feet. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else." Kabir says this: "Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are." Just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are. And again, this is what we're doing in Zazen. And this is about as good a translation of the Heart Sutra as one could hope for. Of course, Kabir had never heard the Heart Sutra. But it's pretty much all there. I said to the wanting creature inside me, what is the 12-link chain of dependent origination? I said to the wanting creature inside me, yep, you're the one who created the form, and that's where all the trouble started. What's this river you want to cross? What other shore? There are no travelers on the river road, and no road. Do you see anyone moving about on that bank or resting? What other shore? There's no river at all, and no boat, and no boatman. There's no tow rope either, and no one to pull it. There's no ground, no sky, no time, no bank, no ford. And there's no body and no mind. Do you believe there's some place that will make the soul less thirsty? Where is it? What is this other shore? In that great absence, you will find nothing. Be strong then, and enter into your own body. This is what we're doing when we do Zazen. Shinge Roshi quoted Bodhidharma in speaking to his disciples, and when Ekka said nothing but sat erect without moving, Bodhidharma said, "You have my marrow." Be strong then and enter into your own body. There you have a solid place for your feet. Enter into your skandhas. You want to find emptiness? Where are you going to find emptiness? You're not going to find it outside the skandhas. Think about it carefully. Don't go off somewhere else. Don't go daydreaming. Don't go thinking that I have to do this or I have to do that. Just be here, right here. Don't go off somewhere else. Kabir says, just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things. Imaginary things like enlightenment, the other shore, wisdom, attainment. It's all junk. Or as Avalokiteshvara said in the Bodhisattva Blues, stop worrying, it's all over anyway. Throw away all thoughts of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are. That last line is such a wonderful line, but there is a danger in that, you know, and the danger is in the what I would call the ignorant son of a bitch slogan. which is, I was born an ignorant son of a bitch. I'm still an ignorant son of a bitch, and I'll die an ignorant son of a bitch. That's not what he means by stand firm in that which you are. Shinge Roshi was kind enough yesterday to tell all of us about the Jewish celebration of Yom Kippur and the need for reflection. And this is very important. And it's not about beating yourself up. It's not about saying, oh, I'm the worst person in the world. Oh, I'll never be any good. Oh, I've done horrible things. Guess what? We've all done horrible things. We've all done things which we lie to ourselves about because they're just so awful that we don't want to tell the truth. We've done things either actively or inactively by commission or omission. We've contributed to problems. The motto for all of our lives could be, mistakes were made. I think that's universal. Mistakes were made. And it's important to stand firm in that which you are, but with an open heart and an open mind and with honesty and without exaggeration and without self-pity or self-blame. To acknowledge the ways in which mistakes have been made. To acknowledge places where we were unkind, uncaring, wasteful. Standing firm in that which you are doesn't mean ignoring all of that. It's not, I'm an ignorant son of a bitch and I'll die an ignorant son of a bitch. It's standing firm in the process of opening your heart and opening your mind. Knowing that really things could not have been otherwise, even though because of our delusion of a separate self-entity, we think that we're responsible for all of this. It's all about me. I'm the one who made those mistakes. Looking at it from one perspective, mistakes were made. Looking at it from another perspective, it's impossible to make mistakes. You did exactly what the universe demanded that you do at that particular moment. And it's up to you to take whatever that karma is and to purify it, to transform it. And it's important to have those two ways of looking at things, to be able to reflect and say, mistakes were made, and to feel the gravity of the situation and the sorrow, regret. But at the same time, to also have that non-dualistic view that mistakes cannot be made. The universe does not make mistakes. And if you think that you somehow are master of the universe and you decided to make this mistake, it doesn't work that way. It's important to see things both ways. It's not that one is correct and the other is incorrect. They both have value. They're both necessary. It's not all about you. It's getting late, but I want to just give you one more Kabir poem because it's so wonderful to spend time in Kabir's mind. And it's so fitting for session. This one is called Runaway Mind, and it's translated by Arvind Krishna Mehrotra, Runaway Mind. The mind's a short-changing huckster with a crafty wife and five scoundrel children. It won't change its ways. The mind's a knot, says Kabir, not easy to untie. Listen carefully. Neither the Vedas nor the Quran will teach you this. Put the bit in its mouth, the saddle on its back, your foot in the stirrup, and ride your wild runaway mind all the way to heaven. When greed hits you like a wave, you don't need water to drown. Whether it's a king on his throne or a pretty queen, a chanting pandit or a miracle-working yogi, they'll all die by drowning in a waterless sea. Who survives? The ones whose minds, Kabir says, are tied to rocks. Brother, the storm of wisdom has hit us. The screens of pretense are blown away. The ropes of Maya have snapped. The ridgepole of delusion is broken. The poles of two-mindedness have collapsed. Smashing them to bits, the roof of desire has fallen on the vessels of wickedness. After the storm, a drizzling rain soaking me through and through. Seeing that dawn, says Kabir, my mind lit up. And although that would be a wonderful place to end, I do want to put in a shameless self-promotional plug. If you like these poems and you see the value of this form of communication. I am going to be teaching a course online on Zen poetics. It would be lovely if any of you would be able to sign up for it and to participate. There will be no end of wonderful poetry being shared. Most of the poems that we are discussing, I will, and I have, typed out and will send to you, so you don't necessarily have to buy any books for it. Of course, if you would like to buy books for it, I will give a reading list of things that some of my favorite poets. That's going to begin in the middle of this month. It'll be every Sunday afternoon at 4, every Sunday that we're not in session either here or at New York Zendo. And the classes will be recorded, so if for whatever reason, perhaps postponing classes that interfere with the Syracuse Zen Center schedule, but anybody who misses because of that or because of illness or any other reason can make up the class by watching it online. It will be via Zoom, and Zoom recordings will be available immediately after the class. Okay. Kabir is one of my favorite poets, and there are many, many wonderful translations.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.